Tyrants, Propaganda, and a New Play. Join me for the second episode about ancient Sicily on the Ancient History Hound podcast. Hi, my name's Neil, and in this episode, I'm continuing the story of ancient Sicily. In part one, New Neighbours, I gave an overview of the island's history up to and including the early Phoenician and Greek colonies. This took me through to the end of the 7th century BC. In this episode, I'll be introducing a couple of new colonies and a lot more action, which takes us from 600 BC through to the middle of the 5th century BC. Before I begin, though, the standard appeal for any reviews or such that you can give on the platform that you're using to listen to this episode. There'll also be a set of episode notes on my website, ancientblogger.com, which will include a transcription, reading list, and the sources I've used. There'll also be maps and anything else I think might help. As for social media, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and X as Ancient Blogger. This podcast also has its own X account, at Hound Ancient. I'm always eager to hear from you, so feel free to get in touch. And if you are old school enough to consider email, then ancientblogger@hotmail.com is where you can find me. Okay, that's it. Let's head on then with the episode. It wouldn't be fair to start without giving the briefest of overviews as to where we are. It's 600 BC and Sicily has three main cultural groups on the island. First up are the indigenous Sicilians. Now, in part one, I mentioned how the names often used for this group, Elymians, Sicanians, and Sicels, is problematic, given that they are labels Thucydides, the 5th century BC historian, allocated to them. Though these labels do help, and they distinguish this group from others and establish that there were different regional differences, there are issues as to exactly how accurate they really are. After all, they were created in accordance with how Thucydides understood the ethnic layout of Sicily in his time. In fact, many of the papers and articles I've read have a sort of caveat when they use them, and I'm going to continue as per episode 1 and refer to the indigenous people of the island as just that, indigenous, Sicilians, locals, local tribes, you get the idea. The next demographic are the Phoenicians. In the 8th century BC, they had established a settlement on the western tip of the island called Motia, and this grew into a substantial location. Finally, we've got the Greeks, who largely settled their colonies on the eastern coast of Sicily. Though I use the umbrella term of Greek, these were colonies founded by different Greek city-states. These inherited the rivalries of their parent cities, and were often in strong competition with each other. On the eastern coast, there were colonies such as Syracuse and Naxos, but there were also colonies elsewhere. On the northern coast was Himera, notable because it was quite near the western end. One colony we hear a lot about is Gela, situated on the southern coast but more towards the eastern end. To these settlements, I need to add a couple more. The colony of Megara Hyblaea was another colony on the eastern coast, just north of Syracuse. The name of the colony gives away where the settlers came from, Megara in mainland Greece. The settlement seems to have been founded in the latter quarter of the 8th century BC, so perhaps shortly after Naxos and Syracuse. The settling of this colony doesn't seem to have been a simple affair. Thucydides wrote that the Megarians were joined by Chalcidians who finally settled the colony once a local king had given them land to do so, and this king was called Hyblon. Megara Hyblaea therefore took his name. We could of course argue that this was retrospectively applied, a myth which explained the name. It still posits that it could be easily believed that colonies were settled with some form of cooperation from locals. Megara Hyblaea joined with the practice of settling its own colonies, and the result was a sub-colony called Selinus. The exact details behind this aren't clear, though Thucydides wrote how Megara Hyblaea had asked its parent city for assistance in this sub-colony. As to the date, this too isn't clear, though archaeological records suggest that by the mid-7th century BC, there was a Greek presence at the location. On the topic of location, Selinus was unique in this context. Where most Greek colonies had been on the eastern third of the island, Selinus was almost at the western end of the southern coast. This was deep into what might be considered the Phoenician region, And this has prompted queries as to why you'd choose that location. Was it some sort of aggressive posturing? Perhaps. Though the answer was probably more due to the lack of space in the eastern third of the island and the commercial advantage of being located nearer to Motya, where it could literally set up shop and access that market, as well as the indigenous settlements nearby. The final two colonies, much like Salinas, were sub-colonies. In 600 BC, Syracuse added Camarina to the south of it, and this I'll be mentioning later because it's a good example of how the parent-sub-colony relationship can really degrade. Finally, in or around 580 BC, there was Akragas. This was a sub-colony of Gela and sat roughly in the middle of the southern coast. Today, it's known as Agrigentum. Now, so far, I've probably given you the impression that founding a colony was an easy thing. Just turn up with a bunch of people and there you have it. Well, that wasn't exactly the case, though. And one example dated to the early 6th century BC and another towards the end of it show what can happen when it all goes wrong. Diodorus Siculus, a Greek historian born in Sicily in the 1st century BC, wrote an account of Pentathlus, who arrived on the western part of the island with settlers intending to found a colony there. The date mentioned by Diodorus was the 50th Olympiad, which gives us a period between 580 and 576 BC. When he arrived, he found Salinas in conflict with Egesta, modern-day Segesta, an indigenous settlement in the western corner of Sicily. Pentathlus threw his lot in with his fellow Greeks of Salinas, but fell in the fighting, and the remaining settlers decided to leave. Later that century, a frustrated Spartan prince called Dareus also tried his hand at settling a colony in Sicily. When his father died, he contested the throne with his elder half-brother, Cleomenes, but it was Cleomenes who was successful. Dareus, realizing that he was unlikely to ever become a king, set his eyes overseas. After a failed attempt at a colony in Libya, he headed west and to Sicily, and specifically the western area of it. However, when he arrived, he was defeated by a force of Phoenicians and local tribes. This was said to have occurred around 510 BC. Just a bit of trivia about Dareus. He had a younger brother who also died fighting non-Greeks outside of Sparta, a certain Leonidas, who met his end at Thermopylae. To these accounts, we can add the inscription dated to the mid-6th century BC of a fallen Greek named Aristogeitus, who was buried at Salinas. The inscription records how he fell in fighting at the walls of Motya. Though as no context is given, we don't know the exact reason for this. These are scattered accounts, but share common ground in where the action happened, western Sicily. Nothing substantial can be argued from this in terms of major relations, though there is the sense of the Phoenicians backing their local neighbours. The likelihood of small skirmishes between groups was high, given that there were groups competing for resources and land. Disputes were often settled this way. Perhaps where Pentathlus and Dareus went wrong was assuming that they could settle where they wanted without performing what we might now term the correct due diligence. Though a lot occurred in the 6th century BC, I want to pick up on two main events, one affecting the Greeks and the other Motya, though in truth, they affected the whole island. The first takes me to Akragas, the Greek sub-colony of Gela, until around 570 BC. It was here where an individual called Phalaris made his play for sole power. According to Polyanus, this individual had been a tax collector, and the people of Akragas trusted him with building a new temple to Zeus. Needless to say, Phalaris happily took the money given to him and started construction. He bought materials needed, but also a large number of workers. I say workers, but these look more like mercenaries and prisoners. Well, that's because they were. When the right moment came, Phalaris used them to seize control and made himself a tyrant of Akragas. He lasted until 554 BC when a revolt ended both him and his reign, and this was often the fate of tyrants. Not always, but often. A quote attributed to Solon sums this up neatly. Being a tyrant was a good place to be, but a hard place to get out of. Aside to his use of deception, Phalaris' main claim to fame, or perhaps infamy, was the Brazen Bull, a hollow bronze bull which a person was placed into and a fire lit underneath. The brief account of Phalaris contains many familiar elements found in other accounts of tyrants. There was the deception and trickery, often employed to seize power. Also, there was cruelty. The image of the tyrant became a byword for bad deeds and corrupted power, and this is certainly the usage of it today, yet things weren't always that way. The relationship a tyrant had with his city and people might be beneficial. It could also exist without the cruelty, and in some instances, they were widely praised. I'm planning to do a mini-sode on the Greek tyrants while I expand on all of those points, so keep an ear out. The tyrants of Sicily had something their counterparts elsewhere in Greece often didn't have: non-Greeks as neighbours. Where in mainland Greece a tyrant might be restricted by the boundaries of his city-state, on Sicily there wasn't that sort of restriction. This led to the likes of Phalaris and other tyrants campaigning to grow their lands, and usually this was at the expense of the locals. But as you'll hear, not always. At the western end of the island, the Phoenician colony of Motia might have looked across and arched an eyebrow. Could the emergence of tyrants cause them an issue? What might happen if a few formed a power block and decided that Motia was on the menu? So it came to pass that Motia was attacked in the middle of the 6th century BC, and it was captured. Not by a Greek tyrant, though. In fact, not even a Greek. Instead, the invasion came from across the sea and another Phoenician colony on the rise, Carthage. It was around this time that Carthage started to flex its muscles and influence the Phoenician colonies of the western Mediterranean. Motia might have been targeted because it was a strong rival and occupied a very good location. Its strategic importance made more so because of the significance of Sardinia at this time to Carthage. There were probably a number of good reasons why Carthage made this bold move. A layer of burnt debris dated to 550 BC is found across Motia, and this is the telltale evidence of citywide destruction. But out of this ashen layer, archaeologists can also point to growth. Once the city was taken, a mass building program took hold in Motia. The Carthaginians had come to conquer, but more importantly, to improve. The decades following the capture of Motia, it received its first full set of city walls. The Cothon Sanctuary, which I spoke about in episode 1, had a complete makeover. The all-purpose warehouse building levelled, and a circular wall around the sanctuary built to highlight the importance of the sanctuary. The temples were rebuilt, and in the case of the temple to Astarte, it was reorientated and moved 3 metres to the south. The sacred pool was formerly lined with stone, and as an aside, it's been argued that this became a sort of star map, the night reflections upon it being used to chart celestial movements, as well as being a religious place. Other areas you might remember, such as the Acropolis, were reset, and the Kapodatsu Sanctuary to the north had the temple, possibly to Melkart, made grand. By the late 6th century, Carthage was now firmly in charge of the Phoenician-controlled region of Sicily, that is to say, the western tip. Interestingly, an agreement made in 509 BC between Carthage and a growing city in central Italy, Rome, made this formal. The agreement outlined the zones of control and where each party could act and trade. This included what was referred to as the Carthaginian province in Sicily. This point seems as good as any to pick up on how the different cultures on Sicily were getting along. As you might imagine, the word complex needs to be in big neon letters here. Entire papers have been written on the significance of a Greek cup found in an indigenous tomb and what it might mean. Evidence of cultural interaction is difficult, even more so where instances of it are restricted to what survived. Even then, forming a direct relationship between material from one group found in the location of another isn't necessarily clear-cut. Take, for example, a tomb at Sabicina, an indigenous settlement. Around 30 objects were found in this, including an Etruscan basin with a non-Greek name and a bronze basin with a Greek inscription. It's not easy to conclude which group the owner of it belonged to. Where Greek-style graves are found, for example at Castiglione di Ragusa, did this mean that Greeks were living there? Or were the locals copying this type of burial? What can often be found is evidence of fluidity. It's just not clear on the exact details of the relationships involved. There is plenty of evidence to support that people of different cultures lived together. A rather touching inscription at Castiglione di Ragusa commemorates a man and a woman who had been buried together. Where the woman's name was in Greek, it seems to have been that the man's name was a local one. At Naxos, indigenous cups have been argued as supporting locals having moved there and were living there. Often the finds included Greek pottery or pieces of it. This had been imported in Sicily for several centuries and is commonly found in tombs where it existed as an item showcasing the wealth of the deceased. But not always. A cup from Morgantina, a local settlement, and dated to before 470 BC, had "I am Kupara," or "I belong to Kupara," inscribed upon it. This isn't unusual per se, but Kupara was a local Sicilian name, not a Greek one. Inscriptions found across Sicily remind us that there were slightly different variations of the Greek alphabet. The indigenous Sicilians sometimes borrowed letters or structures from the Greek alphabet type used by a nearby Greek colony, proof that the Greeks were influencing their neighbours. Some inscriptions found on shards, for example one found at Motia, may have been as the result of non-Greeks, in this case a Phoenician, practising their Greek. Indeed, fragments found at Motia from a necropolis indicate that there were Greek inscriptions there. At Motia, it wasn't just Greek though. Changes in Phoenician inscriptions over the course of the 6th century and through to the 5th century BC have been used to suggest that there was a locally evolving Phoenician language there, which could be called Phoenician Sicilian. Though the Phoenicians imported Greek wares, it wasn't all one way. At the Greek colony of Salinas, not far from Motia, we have amphorae with Punic stamps on them. It wasn't just Greek pottery being traded. Commercial activities went in all directions. As for religion, and again with a caveat that there are weighty tomes written entirely on this, we can find the indigenous peoples worshipping their own deities, but also new ones. At Eryx and western Sicily, the Phoenician deities of Astarte and Tanit were worshipped. It seems in the case of Tanit, this was also considered close to a local deity there. The Greeks also imported their deities, and two of which seem to have become very popular on the island, were Demeter and Persephone. The three cultural groups traded, loved, lost, and lived alongside each other, and yet there was that buzzing of conflict about the place. It's unclear how this dynamic was managed. The Greeks seem to have been the aggressors most of the time. This itself was born from competition with other Greeks, the instances of tyrants, and competition with Carthage and its trading networks. At the western end of Sicily, the local peoples and the Carthaginians don't seem to have had much of the same issues. All of that comes with a caveat of a generalised statement, though, and acknowledging the paucity of sources representing all groups which we have on this. Starting at the end of the 6th century BC, the background buzzing of conflict would be turned into a loud roar. But before I begin, I want to give a quick shout out to something which you might be interested in, particularly if you're a fan of Dungeons & Dragons. Recently, I stumbled upon a post about Labyrinth and Lyre on Reddit. It's an enhancement to the Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition basic rules. It includes aspects of ancient Greek culture and myth, with adventures, new races, and loads of monsters. The creator is Jason Lehrer, who's a longtime D&D player, so this comes from a love of that and ancient Greek myth and history. That's Labyrinth and Lyre, L-Y-R-E. There's a Kickstarter which has already been successful, it's hit its target, so why not go and search for it online and have a look for yourself? Just a reminder that any ads or promos I have aren't paid for. I don't have a Patreon or have any income streams from this podcast, nor do I intend to. When it comes to ads and promos, my ethic is just to share other podcasts, projects, or anything I think might interest you, the listener of this podcast. That's just in case you're wondering. And if you've got anything you might think that the listeners would be interested in, just contact me. Back then to the episode, and to Gela, which debuted its first tyrant around 504 BC. His name was Cleander, and we don't know much about him save that he was assassinated in 498 BC by a local called Sibyllus. This assassination didn't lead to a return to the political norm. Instead, perhaps due to the civil disruption, Cleander's brother Hippocrates took charge as tyrant. Hippocrates' rule lasted 7 years and ended not at the blade of an assassin, but in a battle against a local tribe. However, in that time, Hippocrates had made a huge impact, not only on Gela, but most of the eastern third of Sicily. It wasn't just the locals who fell to his ambition as he increased the dominance of Gela in the area around it. The Greek colonies of Naxos, Catana, and Leontini were all captured and now came under his rule. At Zancle in the northeastern corner of Sicily, he seems to have placed an individual called Scythes in charge. We'll hear about him shortly. Sticking out like a sore thumb, though, was Syracuse, and Hippocrates made a play for it. After defeating Syracusans at the Helorus River, it seemed that he might have found that last piece of the puzzle, but Syracuse's parent city, Corinth, saved the day, and so Hippocrates was forced to settle with a deal that gave him Camarina, a sub-colony of Syracuse, instead. Camarina wasn't Syracuse, but it wasn't all that bad either. This colony was located, as I said, on the southeastern corner of Sicily, and so strategically, it was a good platform from which Hippocrates could launch another attack on Syracuse. According to the sources, he even resettled it, which probably means he moved his troops there, making it more a military base. However, Hippocrates never got to make that next move, as in 491 BC, he was killed fighting those locals. Before I head to the next tyrant in the southeast of Sicily, I need to pick up on someone I mentioned a moment ago, Cythes, who'd been placed in charge of Zancle. This was a strategically important point, as it governed the crossing of the Straits of Messina, a narrow channel of water between it and the toe of southern Italy. On the other side of the channel was the Greek colony of Rhegion, modern-day Reggio Calabria. This was a Greek colony and boasted its own tyrant called Anaxilas. An obvious move for Anaxilas would be to take Zancle, and he had a cunning plan exactly how he could achieve this. The story goes that he made contact with Greek settlers who were on their way to Sicily and offered them the opportunity to take Zancle. This could be easily done as Cythes was out on campaign, presumably against local tribes. The new settlers were successful, and when Cythes returned, he found himself essentially locked out of his own city. When he appealed to Hippocrates for help, Cythes didn't get the response he'd hoped for. Rather than support, he found himself in chains, the price of failure. Hippocrates then proceeded to do a deal with Zancle and went on his way. As for the Greeks who had taken Zancle, their celebrations didn't last that long, as Anaxilas seized Zancle from them. He then changed the name of Zancle to Messina, which you may recognise. This after the name of the region in the southern Peloponnese, which he had grown up in. When Hippocrates had died in 491 BC, the scene was set for his sons to take over. However, the people rebelled against them. Keen to save the situation, Hippocrates' cavalry commander Gelon stepped forward and helped the sons crush the revolt. He then betrayed them and took power. Or at least, that's how Herodotus framed the rise of Gelon, the next tyrant of Gela. Gelon inherited a very strong position. He controlled most of the eastern third of the island. But there was the issue with Syracuse, which now must have seemed even more important to capture. Lady Luck smiled on Gelon in the guise of civil unrest there. It seems that the nobles and the poor were at each other's throats. When the nobles came to him, Gelon was only more than happy to help out, and so in 485 BC, Syracuse was added to his portfolio. Syracuse now became his base of operations, with Hieron, Gelon's younger brother, placed in charge of Gela. The only thing left to do was ensure that there was no more unrest, and Gelon cast his eyes south to the unruly sub-colony of Camarina, which seems to have supported local tribes against its parent city. The solution was easy. Camarina was retaken and the people transferred to Syracuse, where Gelon could keep an eye on them. This policy of moving peoples became more common. In 483 BC, he captured Megara Hyblaea and destroyed it. The poor were sold into slavery and the nobles moved to Syracuse. Gelon's main achievement, or rather the event which made him famous, was a battle fought in 480 BC. But this wasn't with another Greek colony, sub-colony, or even locals. It was with Carthage. The Battle of Himera, as it came to be known, marked a significant change in the relations between Greeks and Carthage, and just about everyone else on the island. But how exactly had it come about? We can point to earlier examples of tension between Greeks and others on the island, the failings of Dorius, for example. Yet this was more than a skirmish, and to understand what caused Himera, we can examine the two main accounts of it and weigh them up. One is from Herodotus, the 5th century BC historian, and the other from Diodorus Siculus, a Greek, as I mentioned, born on Sicily, who wrote in the 1st century BC. The two present very different accounts of what led to it all. Herodotus framed a Carthaginian involvement as almost incidental. In his account, battle resulted due to the conflict between Tyrillus, the Greek tyrant of Himera, and Theron, the Greek tyrant of Acragas. Tyrillus had been forced out of Himera by Theron, and he wanted his city back. In a search for backers, Tyrillus turned to Anaxilas, who I mentioned earlier, who was also his son-in-law. Anaxilas, in turn, suggested Carthage might be happy to support them, and so a large Carthaginian force arrived. Theron, in turn, was backed by Jellon. What we have here is an old-fashioned falling out, with Carthage simply providing muscle in a Greek tyrant versus Greek tyrant showdown. Diodorus Siculus has it very different. This was much, much bigger than Sicily. His account stated that the reason behind the battle was Persia. I know. As part of their war against the Greeks, they had conspired with Carthage to attack the Greeks on Sicily. This version of events elevates the Battle of Himera as part of the wider Greeks versus Persians wars of the early 5th century BC. The date of the battle also links in with this. Diodorus has it occurring on the same day as Thermopylae, and even Herodotus, whose narrative is less linked to that whole Persian thing, has it on the date of another battle, that of Salamis. For Diodorus, this continued the theme of elevating the battle to the pan-Hellenic struggle of Persia against the Greeks. Herodotus, however, may have been simply aligning dates or making that association with far less emphasis. Whatever the reasons, and even to what extent the date is accurate, the outcome of the Battle of Himera was a defeat for Tyrillus and Carthage. Herodotus has the Carthaginian commander Hamilcar throwing himself on a pyre that he was using to make sacrifices with when he heard about the outcome. Diodorus has a slightly different version of Hamilcar's end. This one involved, you guessed it, a cunning plan, in which a contingent of Jellon's cavalry sneaked into Hamilcar's camp, killed him, and then set fire to the ships. Diodorus is also at great pains to underline how much of a massive victory this was. In fact, the news of it inspired the Greeks to defeat Persia, quite a claim. Indeed, he even extols it as better than what the Greeks achieved. After all, the Persian king had survived along with some of his men, whereas here, the enemy leader was killed and almost all of his men slaughtered. Following the battle, Carthage signed a treaty with Jellon, and this included a large payment, which he used to build temples to Demeter and Persephone in Syracuse. It also required that Anaxilas' daughter was married to Hieron, Jellon's younger brother. The political situation had been quelled, though Jellon was keen to ensure that the outcomes further cemented his power in Syracuse and beyond. The temples to Demeter and Persephone would appease those recently brought into the city, both deities being very, very popular. Jellon could also point to the threat of Carthage and his position as defender of the Greeks to further justify his position to any naysayers. The need for justification and ensuring stability led to a grand piece of political theatre. In 479 BC, he appeared in front of the people and essentially handed himself in. He would accept any charge levelled at him. Instead, those present acclaimed him saviour and leader. In a sense, Jellon looked to repackage himself as a legitimate leader, no longer a tyrant, but someone in power because those in Syracuse wanted him to be. The image of a successful leader was promoted outside of Sicily. At Olympia, Jellon dedicated a large statue of Zeus and three corselets taken from the battle. Diodorus referred to something even grander, a golden tripod worth 16 talents sent to Delphi. There is a debate as to the dedications and what they signified at Delphi, whether they celebrated this victory or just Jellon in general. But in either case, Jellon was working to set his image into the eyes of the wider Greek world. This image didn't last long, though. In 478 BC, Jellon died, and his younger brother Hieron took power. He was a strong advocate of the arts. Famous poets such as Bacchylides and Simonides attended his court. Even the playwright Aeschylus made an appearance and became part of a grand project, but I'll get to that in a moment. Where Jellon had Himera as his defining moment, Hieron had Cumae. This was a naval battle which pitted the Greeks of southern Italy against the Etruscans. Hieron sent a fleet, and in 474 BC, in the Bay of Naples, the Battle of Cumae was fought, and the Greeks were victorious. Hieron was not shy, far from it, in projecting this as a great success. Another dedication at Delphi, and helmets from the battle sent to Olympia. In addition to this, Hieron turned to the power of words, in the form of odes written by both Pindar and Bacchylides. These odes celebrated Hieron's victories in the games at Delphi and Olympia, which added to his prestige. But within these odes were key messages, which were equally as important. In these works, we hear how Hieron had saved Greece from bondage, and how Cumae was the equal of Salamis. They also elevated the victory at Himera, putting it in the pantheon of victories the Greeks had against the Persians. The victory of Himera, though proclaimed, was also reshaped. Gellon wasn't named as victor, and instead the success of the victory was portioned to the sons of Dinomenes, namely Gellon and Hieron. It was a neat trick. Gellon's direct association removed and reworked as a sort of family success. Elsewhere, the odes proclaimed his wisdom in rule and general awesomeness. Just take this line from Bacchylides, and I quote, "Hieron, you have displayed to mortals the most beautiful flowers of prosperity. Silence is no ornament for a successful man." End quote. As you've probably worked out, Hieron was definitely not quiet about his success. Hieron did face a challenge back at home. In 472 BC, Theron, the co-victor at Hemera, died, and his son Thrasydaeus decided to challenge him. The two forces met, with Hieron victorious. Peace was made with Acragas, and it duly exiled Thrasydaeus. But the real achievement back home was wrapped in Hieron's concern about legitimizing his reign, giving it credibility, and giving himself a legacy. This he partially achieved through the refounding of Etna. This might sound odd, but perhaps think of it as an early form of rebranding. The old settlement of Catana was refashioned, its borders expanded and given the new name of Etna. The original inhabitants, perhaps the poorer contingents, were moved to Leontini along with those from Naxos, which was then depopulated. Etna was furnished with 5,000 Syracusans and 5,000 arrivals from the Peloponnese. But why? Well, Diodorus gives us two reasons. The first was that this was a reliable source of support close to Syracuse, and the other was that he could be honoured as a founder. The former reason makes sense. The concern that Gellon had had was that the city might turn against him, and this threat still existed, and so Hieron was employing a policy of control. Moving people about and mixing them up destabilised any possible revolt, or at least helped mitigate it. Now, as for the latter, that he was a founder, well, this needs a bit more explaining. In short, a founder of a city was given special honours. They were considered alongside heroes as deserving of a cult, or at the least, high significance. Needless to say, Hiero, as a founder of Etna, was specifically mentioned in one of Pindar's odes about him. Hieron's employment of the arts and desire to continue the theme of founder found a new form in 475, that of drama. It was this year where Aeschylus produced a play called Women of Etna, and performed it at the new city. Unfortunately, and like so many other tragedies, it never survived, but it seems to have involved a local maiden or nymph named Thalia. She was pursued by Hera after she had a liaison, shall we say, with Zeus, and then she bore twins as a result. The themes and characters seems to have knitted local myths and traditions with Greek sensibilities. Though we can only speculate, it's plausible that the play also pointed to the city's foundation in some way. In fact, it would be unlikely, highly unlikely, for Hieron to miss a chance to make a point on the grand stage. Hieron had undoubtedly continued to grow and cultivate a brand of respectability, but peek a bit closer and those flowers of prosperity written by Bacchylides might also look a bit like weeds. He still had the instincts of a tyrant, the shifting of populations to mitigate rebellion, establishing Etna as a sort of safety base nearby, and no consideration given to those he forced out of their homes. Aristotle commented that Hieron had informers and spies in place, keeping him informed of what was being said at all times. When Hieron died in 467 BC, he was buried, as a founder would be, in the city he founded, Etna. But he didn't rest in peace. Those he'd forced from Etna returned afterwards and destroyed his grave. What followed Hieron's death was infighting over who would take over and failures of those who did. Thrasybulus, his brother, lasted less than a year but did have that rare thing, retirement. Perhaps sensing the mood, he cut a deal to live out nicely at Locri in southern Italy. Now tyrant-free Sicily moved to a democracy. Their time with tyrants was done, or at least for a while. That brings me to the end of the tyrants at Syracuse, or be it in this episode. Before I finish up, I'd like to briefly sum up where we are. By the time of the mid-5th century BC, Sicily was very important, a significant location for the ancient Greeks. The colonies there had developed into strong and culturally significant places. Aside from the building in the southeast of Sicily, there was Acragas with its temple to Zeus. This was the largest Doric temple constructed in Greece, measuring 110 metres by 53 metres. For comparison, the Parthenon measures 69 by 30 metres. This period also witnessed the Greek colonies experiment with new designs, the telemon, an architectural feature where a male figure, arms folded or upright, acted as a support, was first seen here. There was also the coinage, exquisite, with each colony reflecting its own symbolism on them. For example, Acragas with the crab and Salinas with the leaf. I recently posted some of these on my website, ancientblogger.com, so I'll be sure to link them into the episode notes. Outside of Sicily, these colonies were sending participants to the Pan-Hellenic Games and winning. At Delphi, you could see the treasuries they'd built there. These weren't backwards colonies with potential. They were effectively city-states of their own. In the next episode, I'll be unwrapping what happened next. Carthage had been bruised, but it was certainly not out of the fight. There was a rebellion on the island, and one of the biggest disasters in Greek military history. Oh, and another tyrant who was terrified of getting his hair cut. In the meantime, rate and review if you can, but more importantly, keep safe and stay well.